Coming up, Kim Lawton on Hollywood's year of biblical epics. What are the potential pitfalls?
How do you walk down that fine line between saying, I want to be respectful to the text, but as an artist, I also want to bring something new?
Also, Bob Fall reports on Southern Baptists, especially the young, reviving the theology of John Calvin, the 16th century reformer.
Calvinism, just by its very nature, gets right to the reality of the one true and living God.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. President Obama this week hailed the successful sign-up process of the Affordable Care Act. He said the law affirms the dignity and worth of millions of Americans. Faith leaders were among those at the White House when the president announced that the plan's original goal of 7 million enrollments had been exceeded. Many religious groups had actively worked to get people signed up before the March 31st deadline. Faith-based groups are mobilizing to help victims of the deadly mudslide in Oso, Washington. Congregations across the nation are offering prayers and taking up special collections for those who lost homes and other possessions. Denominational disaster relief groups are organizing teams of volunteers to help with cleanup and recovery, although many areas are still inaccessible. Vatican officials are busy preparing for the canonization, declarations of sainthood, of the late Popes John Paul II and John the 23rd on April 27th. The beatification of John Paul in 2011 was a lavish affair, but this week the organizers of the canonization said it will have less pageantry. Still, the canonization will be broadcast live in 3D in more than 600 theaters around the world. Atlanta Catholic Archbishop Wilton Gregory issued an apology this week for considering a move into an expensive new residence. Gregory had been criticized for building a 6,000 square foot mansion that cost $2.2 million. In his letter to a Catholic newspaper, the Archbishop admitted to failing those under his leadership and damaging his own credibility. Gregory praised the humble lifestyle of Pope Francis and said, quote, "The world and the church have changed." He said the mansion will probably be sold. A delegation of U.S. Catholic bishops celebrated Mass at the U.S.-Mexico border this week to draw attention to human suffering caused by current immigration policy. Calling for comprehensive immigration reform, they cited 6,000 migrants who have died in the attempt to enter the U.S. since 1998. Among those distributing communion was Cardinal Sean O'Malley. He said the trip was inspired by Pope Francis's concern for migrants. A federal appeals court this week ruled that New York City can ban religious groups from holding worship services in public schools outside of school hours. The decision overturns a 2012 ruling that had allowed churches to worship in public schools. It's unknown if New York City will implement the ban, but Mayor Bill de Blasio has said he believes churches should be able to worship in school buildings. Meeting in Japan, the UN panel on climate change reported this week that the effects of global warming are increasingly evident. It called on world leaders to act now to help people adapt to the changes and slow them down. A global summit on climate change is scheduled for next year. Meanwhile, a group of young evangelicals in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and on several Christian campuses held a day of prayer for action on climate change. Lebanon this week marked what the UN called a devastating milestone. 1 million Syrians have now registered for official refugee status there. Lebanon's own population is just about 4.5 million, making it the country with the highest per capita concentration of refugees recorded anywhere in the world. The 3-year-old Syrian conflict has created a massive humanitarian crisis. More than 2.5 million Syrians have sought refuge in neighboring countries. The film Noah opened this past week, number one at the box office, but with mixed reviews from religious audiences. 2014 has been called Hollywood's year of biblical epics. Son of God was released in February, and acclaimed director Ridley Scott is expected to release a blockbuster Exodus at the end of the year. Several major studios are now developing other biblical stories, and Kim Lawton looks at the challenges of bringing the good book to the big screen.
Hollywood is always on the lookout for a new box office miracle, and it just might help to start with the best-selling book of all time.
Whenever Hollywood wants to go big, it often goes biblical.
10 years ago, The Passion of the Christ earned $600 million and proved that biblical epics can be very lucrative. Now, new digital technologies have made it easier than ever to adapt spectacular Bible stories for the big screen.
The Bible is loaded with amazing source material, right? Fascinating characters, epic struggles, a big canvas, and global recognition. You know, so obviously for Hollywood looking for source material that they can get that is affordable, that's in the public domain, look no further than the Bible.
But Hollywood is also well aware of the potential pitfalls, not least of which is that people usually know how the story ends.
People don't just know the story. Many of them have really strong feelings about the story.
And therefore, says San Diego State University history professor Edward Bloom, audiences can feel a vested interest in how the story is presented.
The stakes are so high. We're not just talking about a character. We're talking about sacred characters. And we're talking about sacred stories. And so it's not just Noah on screen talking to some powerful force. It's Noah talking to God.
Pepperdine University communication professor Craig Detweiler says this year's epics demonstrate the tricky question faced by filmmakers who take up biblical subjects.
How do you walk down that fine line between saying, I want to be respectful to the text, but as an artist, I also want to bring something new?
The first two biblical epics of 2014 took vastly different approaches.
Jesus! He is the Messiah.
With Son of God, you see something that is maybe tailored specifically towards religious audiences and says this is a film that you will feel comfortable with, that affirms your faith and your understanding. With Noah, you have a more fanciful approach to the Bible that's almost more like a graphic novel.
Noah is banking on the appeal of A-list actors, including Russell Crowe, Emma Watson, Jennifer Connelly, and Anthony Hopkins.
I think the film is a great epic, depicting the struggles of the human being with all his conflicts, his or her conflicts, in a vast and incomprehensible universe.
The Noah story in the book of Genesis is short and doesn't give a lot of details. Director and co-writer Darren Aronofsky, who is known for dark films, filled in the blanks in many envelope-pushing ways. He included major characters not mentioned in the Noah Bible account, some non-human, and he creates key plot points not in the original story either.
If you even look at what's described in the story, it's talking about a time before rainbows, when giant angels walked on the earth, when people lived for centuries. It's clearly a universe that's different than what we understand now. So to treat it as something that's not poetic and mythical is a mistake, I think. I think really what's there is something that can inspire us.
A whole new generation will be reaching into the Bible.
With Son of God released in February, top television producer Mark Burnett and his wife, actor Roma Downey, are offering a story that sticks closely to the gospel accounts of Jesus.
We wanted it to look cool. We didn't want this to be some old donkeys and sandals thing that maybe had good intention but wasn't well executed.
Son of God is an expansion and re-edit of material shot for the Burnett's highly successful miniseries, The Bible, which ran on the History Channel last year. They say they took great care to ensure they got things right.
We worked with academics and scholars, theologians, advisors from all denominations to make sure that we moved forward accurately and truthfully and always in the spirit of the book.
I don't think it's dangerous territory. I think it's just a matter of being respectful and within the spirit.
And being responsible.
But how much responsibility is required from filmmakers and artists?
Religious people want their faith to be taken seriously because they take it seriously, and they want others to consider it, but they're not in charge.
In Noah, Jennifer Connelly plays the main character's wife, who is not even named in the Bible story. She says she looked to other passages about biblical women for help.
I felt a great sense of responsibility, so of course it was very important to me to always consult the Bible. So I found some inspiration in other parts of the Bible because there isn't much to say about her in Genesis. I found Proverbs 31 particularly useful.
Aronofsky says he also read widely and consulted theological advisors.
We thought about it for a really long time and tried to connect it and not contradict anything, but allowed us to have an explanation for why we represented it in that way. But, you know, I imagine there will be people who are literalists who think that a literal interpretation can exist. But that's, you know, as soon as you cast Russell Crowe, you're beyond literalism.
We build an ark.
No matter what, a film is going to alter the literary story just by physically putting a person on screen. And whenever we alter, all of a sudden things can get messy. And so, for instance, it's not just what we put in the film, but what we leave out that might matter as well.
How a Bible film is ultimately viewed often comes down to how people assess the intentions of the filmmakers. And with the newest round of biblical epics, the filmmakers have attempted to be very clear.
People know that we're Christians and know that that we love the Bible.
We want to spread the good news, you know?
Despite his edgy Noah interpretation, Aronofsky has repeatedly said his intention was to wrestle with the story, not disrespect it.
I think people have an idea of what it is, but I think when you look at the material, it can be many things for many people. And that's what's interesting. This is one of the oldest stories ever told, and it's connected to everyone on the planet. It's like it's a treasure for everyone.
But making a biblical epic that a broad audience can treasure is a different story.
The biblical literalist wants, oh, hey, does this match up with Genesis? Does this match up with Exodus? While the more liberal modernist may want the more artistic spirit of the story. But you also have another group. You have those who vigorously dislike the Bible stories. And so how do you get those three groups to like the same thing?
Following the highly successful marketing strategy around the Passion, the Burnetts have been actively reaching out to their target audience, religious conservatives. They've been waging social media campaigns, appearing at faith-based meetings, soliciting endorsements from high-profile religious leaders, and encouraging churches to rent out entire theaters to show Son of God. Mega church pastor Rick Warren was among those on board.
I'm not dumb. I'm smart enough to go, somebody just put a lot of money into that. Time, energy, effort, marketing. We're going to use that to reach more people for Jesus. Okay.
For Noah, Paramount Pictures has been positioning the film as an action movie, but at the same time reaching out to religious audiences, in part to head off potential controversy. Paramount pre-screened the film for some faith leaders and agreed to add a disclaimer to its marketing, which acknowledged that artistic license has been taken and that the biblical story of Noah can be found in the book of Genesis.
I think Hollywood is slowly learning who the religious filmgoer might be and what their concerns are. It's been a tenuous relationship. Hollywood is, I think, trying to do a good job and finding that the sensitivities are much higher and greater than they realized. So it's a process of mutual education.
That's the end of everything.
Beginning.
And no matter the approach, many analysts say they're pleased Hollywood is generating new theological conversations about the Bible.
There's some people who want their entertainment to be comforting, right? And to comfort the afflicted. Other filmmakers, they like to afflict the comfortable. They kind of come at you. And we have churches that do the same. How great that we're at a point where Hollywood is sort of offering both.
And that may be the biggest miracle of all. I'm Kim Lawton in Los Angeles.
When Jennifer Connelly mentioned Proverbs 31, some of us had to look that up. It's a detailed list of the qualities of a virtuous woman. Now, a special report on the revival of Calvinism, the theology preached by John Calvin, the 16th century reformer, who believed whether a person is saved or damned is predestined by God. Bob Fall reports that Calvinism's new popularity is particularly evident among Southern Baptists, especially the young.
Darryl, you have a powerful story. We've all
baptism by immersion to the fervent Bible-based preaching. Sojourn Community Church in Louisville, Kentucky looks and sounds like many other Southern Baptist congregations. What you cannot see, however, is that this Baptist church is infused with Calvinism, the teaching of a 16th century Swiss theologian, John Calvin, whose tenets were practiced by America's Puritans in the 17th and 18th century.
We want a robust, full, holistic understanding of the person and work of Jesus Christ. And Calvinism, or the doctrines of grace, really give us that picture. There's been a rise in Calvinism, for sure. And I think the return to the doctrines of grace, or Reformed theology, is really a desire to return to more foundational truths.
John Calvin's basic belief is the absolute sovereignty of God, that everything is God's will, including who is saved. Albert Moeller is a Calvinist and president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary.
Calvinism is probably about as countercultural as anything you could imagine in a secular America, or secularizing America, because Calvinism, just by its very nature, gets right to the reality of the one true and living God.
The growth of Calvinism in the Southern Baptist Convention has been significant and not always welcome. In one recent survey, 30% of SBC pastors say they consider their churches Calvinist. Dr. Stephen Lemke is provost of the New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary, which is not considered Calvinist. He fears the debate over Calvinism could split the Southern Baptist Convention.
I think there are still people who worry that someday the Southern Baptist Convention could split over this issue. So that continues to be one of the tension lines in the Southern Baptist Convention.
A tinderbox. You make it sound like a tinderbox.
It is, and people feel very strongly on both sides of the issue.
An advisory group within the SBC requested that pastors be forthcoming about their Calvinist beliefs when being considered for a job at a church.
When a young pastor came, and he began teaching and preaching things that was very different than these people had been taught and believed all their lives, that obviously created tensions in churches and led to churches splitting or pastors being fired.
Take this in remembrance of me.
Although Pastor Montgomery and his staff don't use the language of Calvinism when they gather, Montgomery says the essence of Calvinism is embraced by his congregation. His church, he says, is growing because of it. His congregation, he says, is made up of CEOs, suburban moms, and women from strip clubs, and ex-cons from halfway houses.
For some, Calvinism is divisive and unbiblical, but we've really seen the exact opposite in our expression and our embrace of Reformed theology and Calvinism. We've seen that it unifies our efforts. It gives us an understanding that God is at work in this world.
So that's
Professor Ryan Putnam, who teaches at the New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary, says many young people are attracted to Calvinism.
We have a generation that really longs to go into deeper analysis of theology and deeper analysis of biblical studies.
It's more intellectual?
Right, I think so.
Indeed, for Southern Baptists like Steve and Connie Christian, who actually named their son John Calvin, the appeal of Calvinism is its certainty.
There's a depth of thinking there that says we're about the grace of God, and they really think through what it means to be totally captivated by the grace of God.
Calvinism also appeals to some Baptist women who believe the Bible tells them they are enjoined to submit graciously to males.
I have a husband who is, I believe, called by God to be the head of our home, and therefore the responsibility lies with him, and I'm happy with that. In fact, I'm glad that I'm not responsible.
There's no justification for any discrimination on the basis of gender unless the Creator has told his church, this is how I expect you to organize your church in obedience to me, and this is how I expect you to organize your marriage in obedience to me. And I do believe we're under that authority.
At Baptist seminaries, one of the most contentious issues dividing Calvinist and non-Calvinist is predestination, the belief that God selects some but not all souls for salvation. If some are chosen and if, in the lexicon, others are frozen, if from the outset everything is predetermined, then, non-Calvinists argue, what is the point of evangelism? But at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, the dean of the Billy Graham School of Missions, a Calvinist, argues that predestination and evangelism go hand in hand.
We don't know who the elect or the non-elect are. So we preach that whosoever will may come. We preach an indiscriminate gospel, and we leave the matters in terms of election and predestination. Those are God's business, not mine.
Southern Baptists who are Calvinists also maintain that the belief that not all are chosen for salvation is something in the gospel that cannot be explained.
It's a tension that we see throughout human history, and typically what we try to do with tension is we try to choose sides. Well, is God sovereign or are we responsible? And I would argue that that's a tension that we're to live in and a paradox that we're to embrace rather than completely solve.
But no matter how Calvinists attempt to explain predestination, that doctrine, for Baptists who are not Calvinist, is troublesome.
Many of us have concern about the notion that God from eternity just chose a certain number of people to be elect, and that Christ came to die only for that small group of people.
And Lemke asked, what happens to personal responsibility, and what kind of image of God does Calvinism portray?
Sometimes we worry that the emphasis on wrath or righteousness seems to be overriding the statement that's very clear in Scripture that God is love, and he does allow human response to play a role, and we are accountable for our choices.
Though the Southern Baptist Convention is the country's largest Protestant denomination, membership and baptisms are down, fueling the debate on whether Calvinism is a catalyst for growth or a hindrance. Even so, Dr. Mueller sees the debate over Calvinism as being positive.
I think it's a fantastic thing when you imagine that mainline Protestant denominations have largely been arguing over things like same-sex marriage and any number of other things, and trying to figure out how in the world to engender some kind of genuinely theological discussion. I think we should see this as a tremendous achievement of the Southern Baptist Convention. The question is now how we steward that.
A stewardship which thus far has resulted in growth and growing pain. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Bob Fall in Louisville, Kentucky.
Orthodox Jewish feminist leader Rivka Haut died of cancer this week. She was 71. Haut was one of the first Orthodox Jewish women to teach the Talmud. She founded Women of the Wall, a group that fights for the rights of women to pray with the Torah at the Western Wall in Jerusalem. Finally, on our calendar this week is Navaratri, a 9-day Hindu festival honoring the female deity Durga. The festival culminates with a celebration of Lord Rama. And that's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. And visit our website, where there's always much more, including more of Kim's interviews from Hollywood. You can also listen to or watch each of our programs. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, Why Should the Devil Have All the Good Music? By the late Larry Norman, one of the founders of contemporary Christian rock. His 1972 album, Only Visiting This Planet, was one of only 25 recordings selected by the Library of Congress this year for its National Recording Registry.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.